When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Wicked Problems. I'm Richard Delavan.
I think I've become a little bit more diplomatic as I've got older, and I happily kind of rub shoulders with my right-wing colleagues and say, look, let's have a coffee and have a chat, and we might agree or we might disagree. I was probably a little bit more comfortable with the megaphone in 2006. I'm still happy to take one up today, but I think I've learned better listening skills. And particularly when you're dealing with people of all political persuasions from 27 different countries, you absolutely have to listen carefully to the concern that's on their mind. We're watching climate breakdown in real time. I would hope that the extreme weather events will focus our mind on the need to go further and faster. We've doubled energy efficiency and we can do it again. Buildings consume 40% of the energy in the European Union and they are responsible for 36% of the greenhouse gas emissions. So if we tackle buildings, we're well on our way to tackling climate change. The debate around the European elections, I'd like to see it focus on the decade of change and why we need green voices on the European stage in the years ahead.
That was Ciarán Cuff, Green Party member of the European Parliament from Dublin, and the parliamentarian perhaps most responsible for getting enshrined into European law an Energy Performance of Buildings Directive. Europe's millions of drafty buildings consume a third of the EU's energy and emit almost 40% of the bloc's CO2 emissions. The measures, which have been debated since the Commission proposed new rules in 2021. Last week in Strasbourg, EU lawmakers adopted that Energy Performance of Buildings Directive with a large majority, thanks in large part to the chief negotiator, Ciarán Cuff. Now these new rules face one last hurdle in their adoption by the Europe's executive body, the Council for the EU. I first met Ciarán Cuff when he was a city councillor in Dublin. And for the weekend that's in it, here's a word from our unofficial sponsor.
This program is brought to you in part by Ireland, the ancient birthplace of good times.
First came the Vikings, then the Normans, the Saxons. All of them found Ireland irresistible. So think what a grand time we'd show you. Especially since you'd be the only ones of the lot we actually invited. Ireland.
Okay, that's not really from our sponsor, and it's a TV ad from 1986, but that script, just chef's kiss. As I was saying, I met Cuff, who trained as an architect when he was a Green Party member of the Dublin City Council, and not the key parliamentarian on the brink of delivering regulation that will spur climate tech innovation in the built environment that helps bring down those emissions in the world's largest economic bloc, which Europe needs in order to have any chance of achieving its climate goals. And the way the political weather looks so uncertain about climate for the rest of 2024, could this set of rules be the high watermark for climate policy? Elections to the European Parliament here in the UK, in the US, even in Ireland, may see a lot of this progress rest in the balance. So I'm happy Ciarán could join us for this chat, recorded a few weeks ago, As Fáilte Ireland really isn't the sponsor of this podcast, we really would appreciate if you might give us a bit of support by becoming a member at wickedproblems.earth. For less than the price of a pint of Guinness in central London, you can help support our work. Well, enough of that crack. Now, here's my conversation with Ciarán Cuff. Welcome back to Wicked Problems. I'm Richard Delavitt, and I'm so delighted we can be joined today by Green Party MEP for Dublin, Ciarán Cuff. Welcome to the show.
Richard, how are you?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very well. So the last few months have whizzed by. The European Green Deal was a big part of what I was focused on, and we've made progress. So I'm very happy to talk about all of that and what's happening on the global stage as well, because COP28 finished up not too long ago with mixed results, but some progress there too.
Well, let's talk about that to start with, because again, you've had an absolutely stonking year. And I know that your party colleague, Eamon Ryan, the minister, had also played a significant role during the talks as negotiations progressed, ending to this final agreement. Obviously, there has been an outsized influence compared to even perhaps to previous COPs of Green Party members across Europe and their voices and, you know, how that helped shape the negotiations. So tell us a little bit about that in particular. Obviously, you've written it's a bit mixed bag in terms of the final result. But let's talk a little bit about the process and, you know, the role that you and other party colleagues played in helping to deliver it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I guess 4 or 5 years ago, there was a big announcement at a European level that we were going to have a European Green Deal. And certainly within my own political grouping, we've spoken about Green Deals for decades at this stage. But in fairness to Ursula von der Leyen, the incoming president of the European Commission, she said she wanted to deliver it. Now, a lot of it was old stuff, just dressed up with a little bit of green wallpaper on it. But actually, the commitments were pretty strong. And the headline commitment was a 55% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions between the year 1990 and 2030. And we're on course to deliver that. So halving the greenhouse gas emissions in Europe is a pretty big deal. And you don't do that by just waving a magic wand. You do it with all kinds of different legislation. And after we passed the European Climate Law, we then got involved in what was called the Fit for 55 package, Fit for the 55% reductions. And to my count, there's about 20 different pieces of legislation involved in that. Everything from sustainable aviation fuels to the energy performance of buildings, the old reliables like renewable energy, the Renewable Energy Directive, the Energy Efficiency Directive, and then new stuff like a carbon border adjustment mechanism. So if we import stuff into the EU, we want to make sure that the price of the carbon has been paid at the point of entry. So this is a whole new ballgame. There's a lot of unknowns as to how it will play out over the next few years. But I think the headline commitment is still there, even though within the last 6 to 12 months, there's been a bit of a pushback from the right and the far right. I mean, the far right never likes climate action anyway, but the center right, EPP in Germany, they're really pushing back against the European Green Deal. And that's a little bit worrying.
Well, let's come back to that, because with the elections coming up in June of next year for the next European Parliament, there's been a lot of predictions about what might happen and how that might affect the agenda. So let's come back to that maybe at the end. But to start out with, I suppose one of the ways of describing the outcome out of Dubai has been that, you know, there's been I like to think about it as a lagging indicator, right? In the sense that you've got Europe in the forefront, having pushed these policies and therefore having a credible negotiating position that says, we know it's possible because we're actually doing it. We can show how it can be done. I mean, do you feel like that, again, let's talk about your role in pushing one of those particular pieces of legislation about changing, doing a retrofit on building stock across the European Union. So please tell us more about that and your role.
There's 2 points in this. One is that when Europe kind of goes to COP, when we engage in this huge global debate, we kind of come into the room feeling quite proud of ourselves because we're doing the work. But the moment you go into the room, developing countries are saying, oh, yeah, it's him, it's them again, because they would feel that we're part of the problem. We're causing the huge greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, Africa is maybe 2-3% of the global problem, but we tend to focus on, ooh, what's Africa doing? Whereas in Europe, were significant, were a double-digit part of the problem. And we absolutely do need to take action. And in fact, we should be taking more action. So we can't feel too proud of ourselves. But I mean, we do go to the COP and the different European institutions, the European Parliament goes there. We have a delegation from the Environment Committee. And every morning, we sit down with the 27 other member states and we discuss what is being negotiated and the role that the EU can play. So we are a player in the room. And certainly my colleague Eamon Ryan was very present on the issue of loss and damage and the money that's needed to deliver the transition. You know, I looked at one of the NGOs, one of the environmental organizations, and it said, look, what did they want from COP? They wanted a fossil fuel phase out that was fast, fair, full, funded and feminist. I think there's about 7.5 F's in there. What do they get then is the really interesting question. The fossil fuel phase out, well, they got a phase down. So as always, turkeys won't vote for Christmas. So the petro states will not vote for a phase out. But a phase down is as good as you're going to get. And it wasn't bad. Fast, well, they used the word rapid. So that's not bad. Fair, they used just. Full, transition fuels are still in the mix, so we're not going to stop using gas tomorrow, but we need to keep the lights on. And obviously, transition fuels will be in the mix. Funded, I mean, this is about affordability. There's wording around that in the deal. And then the last interesting word is feminist, which, you know, is anathema to some. But the empowerment of women made it in. So in terms of the scorecard, I think we did okay. I think we got an honours mark out of COP. But of course, the political decision-making lags the science. And that is every year. And I've been to 4 COPs at this stage. I didn't go to Dubai. But every year we come out quite frustrated, but progress is made. I mean, one of the issues, as you mentioned there, that I've been working on in Europe is the energy performance of buildings. That's quite a mouthful, but we do know that buildings consume 40% of the energy in the European Union, and they are responsible for 36% of the greenhouse gas emissions. So if we tackle buildings, we're well on our way to tackling climate change. So right. I've been shepherding a new law, the Recast Energy Performance of Buildings Directive, through the Parliament, and then recently negotiations with the European Commission and the Council of Ministers. And I'm glad to say just 2 weeks ago, we struck a deal. And essentially, there will be an obligation on building owners, particularly of public and commercial buildings, to gradually improve the energy performance, heading towards an A energy rating by 2050. Clearly, right. There has to be an opt-out for heritage buildings, for holiday homes, for certain categories. But essentially, the writing is on the wall. We're going to improve their energy performance, and there's an actual obligation on the owners of the commercial buildings. When it comes to homes, it quickly became a very political, a very weaponized file. Mm. So the Italian government under Meloni said, Brussels wants to take your home. So I had to do a lot of outreach and diplomacy there. I even gave a speech in Italian in the European Parliament saying this was part of a just transition and we need to provide the money and we need to help people on the way. So that went down okay. And we got it through. So this means that there will be progress and we have kind of milestones along the way, 2030, 2040, but we're kicking this off. And the kind of grants, I mean, you have it in the UK with a big increase in the last few days for heat pumps, but it's all about heat pumps. It's all about solar panels and it's all about insulation. You know, if realtors say it's all about location, 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 in the world of energy efficiency, Insulation is crucial. Right. And actually coming out of COP, there was a commitment to doubling energy efficiency, which is all about upgrading your home to use less energy. So quite a bit of progress made there.
No, I want to get into some of the specifics because I think Europe, if you know these provisions are implemented, is going to look a lot different in the coming years in the sense that, you know, the rooftop solar provision means that you're going to be seeing an awful lot more of that, you know, and it'll be somewhat leveling up the rest of the union for places that, you know, for which that's already a mandate in some parts of Europe. But in terms of, I mean, and it seems like it's going to be a model that, you know, takes as read that regulation can spawn innovation. And so I think that, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how companies adapt, you know, whether they're in the property sector or whether they're in, you know, kind of more traditionally thought of as climate tech sectors, of how to actually do this. Because the energy efficiency, you know, we're going to be using a lot less primary energy as a result of this mostly electrification. But, you know, tell us about some of these, the key provisions, and like, what were some of the hardest ones to get through?
Yeah. I mean, it is all about innovation. And I mean, I saw an article in one of the Irish papers a few days ago with some property guy bemoaning the vacancy rate in offices and saying, you know, it's all down to these new damn European laws. I mean, he is the equivalent of a guy trying to sell horses in 1910 when these newfangled internal combustion engine vehicles are kind of rolling past his stable. You got to adapt or die. And these building owners will have to renovate and refurbish. I mean, some of the biggest rows were with, obviously, large property owners. So the German residential property sector gave me a hard time, you could say, on several occasions, as did the fossil fuel lobby, Liquid Fuels Europe. There was a lot of astroturfing. There was a lot of setting up websites and saying, oh, people in the countryside won't be able to live in their homes anymore. So I think there was quite a bit of fear mongering, but we tried to get our message out in all of this. You know, this whole process kicked off about 4 years ago because I initially wrote a report on the renovation wave. In a nutshell, we're renovating about 1% of our buildings, a deep renovation every year. We need to get that to 2% or 3%. So I wrote a report on the renovation wave. And the outreach was hugely important. During COVID, I would have sat here doing about 50 different webinars, talking to everybody, talking to the property industry, civil society, the banks. You know, one day you might have Blackstone on a call. Another day you might have Housing Europe. And I listened to the messages that they had. One of the strongest messages coming from the commercial property sector was, give us the direction of travel. Show us how far we have to go, when we have to do it, and we'll deliver. So bringing certainty into it is important. And actually, that's what the European Central Bank said. Unusually, they issued a 20-page opinion on this directive. And they said, look, it has the potential to be a real positive, but you have to be quite clear as to where we're going. And once it's passed, the money will flow. So we have it still has to do a final lap with the tick box of the Council of Ministers, back to the Energy Committee of the Parliament in January, and a final plenary vote in February. But these are mostly a formality. Hopefully it won't come back and kind of come alive like the way the Eisbahn did when the German motor industry said, yes, you've agreed, but actually we want to think again about this.
I was going to ask about that because it was something that I watched that unfold and I felt sick in my stomach slightly watching an exception creep in. So maybe tell us about that and how that played out from your point of view.
Well, you know, politics is the art of the possible. And we've quite a few exclusions. I spoke earlier about heritage buildings, holiday homes, very small homes, obviously. But actually, there's an exclusion. A member state can exclude up to 22% of its building stock. Is this a good thing? I don't think it is. Is it the realpolitik of getting a deal done? Of course it is. So a bit like sausage making, nobody wants to see how laws are made. And the kind of deals you do after being in a room for 10 hours until 4:30 in the morning, sometimes they're ugly, but they are part of the legislative process.
I mean, and it's something that, so, I mean, I want to come specifically back to the ICE ban and what crept in there. So just to remind listeners, this was something that, you know, there was a set date to basically rule out the sale of new internal combustion engine vehicles in Europe. And then that was watered down with a provision, you know, put in, you know, at the behest of, let's say, people who were enthusiastic about keeping for some kinds of ICE vehicles around. And so therefore, e-fuels seem to have got an exemption that allows
fuels,
to get in.
I mean, show me the business case. That's all I can say. Maybe if you're driving a Ferrari and you're feeling nostalgic about something you bought 20 years ago, but I don't see any real case for putting e-fuels into an old-fashioned combustion process. I mean, we're moving. This is a game-changing moment in history where we're moving from molecules to electrons. We're moving from hydrocarbons to electricity. It's changing everything. In some ways, it's a gentle revolution in the way it's impacting on energy, on transport, on construction, on agriculture. But sometimes it can be pretty sharp. I mean, I was kind of waxing lyrical down at the International Energy Agency in Paris a few months ago. I said, it's a gentle revolution. And Fatih Birol, the director of the IEA, he looked at me and said, Ciarán, it ain't been a gentle year for many. And, you know, he's right, because we saw these price spikes of fossil fuels. So if anything, that's a wake-up call that we need to move faster. We need to move away from our reliance on dictators and despots. And we've been using a slogan within the Green Movement, if we insulate homes, we isolate Putin. Because, you know, we have been hugely dependent on Russia for oil, for gas, even for nuclear fuels. And the sooner we move towards good old renewables, the better it will be. And the price spikes should be less as we move forward.
Well, and Fatih Birol took at least as much heat from OPEC as you would have done from the fossil fuel lobby or the property lobby. And I can remember myself, my last day in Irish journalism was, in fact, after having a tangle with one of the larger estate agents at the Sunday Tribune, long lamented, but gone now. But rather than go over that ground, which might get the lawyers involved, let's not do that. But in any case, one of the things you mentioned was that this idea.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
About certainty being so important, and the central bank commenting on this, the IEA. But one of the things that drove, it seems, and had a lot of tailwind behind these changes, part of which you shepherded, was the invasion of Ukraine and the response. It's something that, when I look back at the IEA's energy efficiency report, that there was an 8% progress in 2022 in the European Union in terms of energy efficiency. And that was massively up on the average from the previous kind of 12 years of about 2%. But the reasons for that were obvious, right? We used less fuel where we could. There was a drive for greater, kind of that. And there was, to some extent, a lot of demand destruction where, factory aluminum smelters just closed in a lot of Europe. And we had some of that. And then you saw a bit of a reaction this year where, the efficiency gains were much, much less. And I guess the worry is that as, we're drifting towards either stalemate or something happening, with this, that we're going to lose that impetus. I mean, is that something that concerns you, that we had a lot of progress ahead of steam, but now there's an opportunity for people to take a step back and go, well, do we really need to keep going this fast as we head into next year?
Well, I mean, I think we've no time to wait. And I think this has to be a decade of change. I mean, I would say that, wouldn't I? But I mean, all you need to do is look at your screen and see the extreme weather records that are being broken week in, week out around Europe. I mean, you can see the graph of this year of this mad differentiation between average temperatures and what has happened. So I think we're watching climate breakdown in real time. So as an optimist, and I think to be in politics, you have to be optimistic, I would hope that the extreme weather events will focus our mind on the need to go further and faster, as the NGOs were saying. I mean, the good news is we've doubled energy efficiency, I think, over the last decade in Europe, and we can do it again. Brian Motherway, Irish guy who works in the IEA, he said we can happily double this again over the next 10 years. But certainty is key. And if you look at the rollout of renewables, offshore wind has had a little bit of a wobble because inflation has impacted on everything. Costs have gone up, but also they need the certainty. So if we want to keep rolling out heat pumps, if we want to keep rolling out offshore wind, we need massive amounts of money and we need a lot more certainty. I think there is good news because the European Investment Bank, 2 years ago, they did a kind of a road trip around the parliament saying, we are now the European Climate Bank. And they are very focused on investment in renewables and in climate action. They even said, you know, one of the biggest projects they funded here in Dublin in recent years was an extension to the airport, a third runway. And they said quite openly that that's not the kind of project they would fund anymore. So they are changing their criteria. And another European piece of legislation that has passed that I didn't mention was the European taxonomy. And this is basically selection criteria for what gets the thumbs up for being a green investment. Now, we had quite a row about it because it included nuclear and some forms of gas if it's efficiently burnt. But still, the direction of travel is in the right way. And it means that it will be harder and harder to fund fossil fuel projects, certainly in Europe. And I think Europe is a worked example of what we're trying to do at a global scale. I mean, we've got to learn from what's happening elsewhere as well. Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act is another way of doing things, of giving tax breaks to everybody. I'm not sure if it's perfect. I mean, do you really want to go out and buy a Tesla super truck and say, I'm doing my bit for saving the planet? Of course you're not. But look, Joe Biden again has to deal with the reality of American politics. People want green if they can buy more stuff over there. And if it's green stuff, it's somewhat better than not green stuff. So there's lessons, though, for Europe, because we tend to focus on regulation and diktat. And maybe we should be sprinkling more magic dust around with cheap money for doing the right things. And maybe it's about quantitative green easing in the years ahead. Certainly, I think there's a compelling case for setting up funds that provide the money. And for this building renovation project, the amount of money we need is eye-watering. We're talking trillions over the next 30 years. And I think to deliver that money, we have to provide it at a lower interest rate. Some financial institutions are doing that already, but it's more kind of making it look like they're green. Banks saying, we have a green mortgage or a green loan. But actually in Belgium, you can get a 50,000 zero interest loan for doing the green stuff. I mean, that's unthinkable here in Ireland, but maybe in the years to come, free money for doing green stuff will become part of what we need to do. I mean, with COVID, we've done a lot of unthinkable things over the last few years. And certainly we saw a move to the center, if not to the left, with COVID. And who knows what the next few years will bring.
And I think, I mean, that's, as you look forward into 2024, so you're standing again as a candidate for Dublin as an MEP. 2024 is going to have more people be taking part in elections than any other year in human history. 4 billion people are going to go, you know, are basically live in countries that are going to go to the polls next year, right? So in June, it'll be the turn of the European Parliament where you're standing again for as a candidate. Now, of the headlines, you know, looking at Politico, looking at other, you know, kind of media outlets going, you know, over the last couple of months have suggested that, you know, the headline is a resurgent right of people like the AfD Deutschland, people like Giorgia Meloni, you've already mentioned her party, but that it seems like after making all this progress, and a lot of which you are, you know, had a part in playing this year, that the elections next year could be a harbinger of some kind of a reaction against this. And we've here in the UK, obviously, we've seen, you know, the ruling Conservative Party trying to use a reaction against net zero policies as a way of trying to stoke, you know, their kind of fading electoral fortunes. But, you know, AfD in Germany putting up some very scary numbers. Does it concern you that we might see backsliding as a result of the outcome of the elections next year?
Yeah, it does. And certainly the swing to the right that we've seen in Sweden, in Finland, in Italy, and of course, we've had it for the last decade in Hungary and other Central European countries. But there is some optimism, because it was felt that Poland would stay on the right, and that didn't happen. It was felt that Spain would, and that hasn't happened either. So it's not quite as clear-cut as some would make it out to be. And of course, in the UK, where you are, I think it's clear that the Tories will, certainly they're on a way to perhaps not being in government next time round. Now, we can argue about what Labour represents. But I guess, look, I'm long enough in the tooth in politics to know that a lot can change in a short space of time. And I had a look back at the opinion polls from 5 years ago. And that surge that the Greens got here in Ireland, it only came in the last 2 or 3 weeks before the election. We were coasting along at 2%, 3%, really flatlining. And then suddenly we went up to 7% for the European elections. And that continued for about a year. And we had a national election and we had our best election result ever. So anything can change. And I guess the last 5 years, we were puttering along, complaining about the usual things we complain about. Then suddenly we had, well, Brexit came along, obviously, but that had been in the mix for a while. But as soon as we had finished up with Brexit, COVID broke out. And then as soon as we were kind of getting our breath back after COVID, Ukraine kicked off. And now we have the crisis, the violence in the Middle East. So 6 months is a long time in the kind of the dynamic in Europe. The challenge, though, that we have for the European elections, they are a second order election. People are prepared to do things that they might not do in a national election. So the mood can change quite quickly. I mean, if you ask people in Ireland, what are the big issues? The latest polling is the cost of living, the cost of housing, migration. I mean, I think migration will be an issue. Obviously, Richie Sunak sees that with his three-word messaging that he got from Dominic Cummings. And I think every party will have to have clear messaging on migration and whether that message is about resistance or whether it's about empathy and a understanding. We all need to have clear messaging as to what we're going to do about the fact that there are enormous inequalities in the world. And even though we have our problems in Europe, there's a huge amount of people who would much rather be in Europe than in the failed states that they are coming from.
So as an MEP for Dublin, one of the things that obviously has taken place in the last few weeks that was shocking sitting here in the UK, you know, was the disorder in the Dublin city centre, which at the time many commentators jumped to suggest was related to a desire to limit migration, some of which we could imagine the future is going, you know, everyone agrees is likely to increase as a result of people fleeing areas that are less inhabitable due to climate change. What's going to be your message on the doorsteps as you're, you know, talking to constituents who you're asking for their vote to reelect you to say, you know, to striking that balance between, you know, talking, acknowledging any legitimacy of their concerns, but also, you know, how do you navigate that with you know what you know is coming?
Yeah. I mean, I think migration is part of the way the world is today. And certainly the area I represented in Dublin for 5 years, the North Inner City, was about 40% people who weren't born in Ireland. Those people have made Dublin a much more interesting place in terms of food, culture, employment, and so many different areas. What you're seeing in the UK is the challenge that arises if you limit migration. You're not going to get the health staff. You're not going to get the restaurant staff. You're not going to get the people who are prepared to do the work that maybe some others would not do. But of course, we do need to tackle the challenge of immigration. I think we need to revisit the Dublin regulation, which goes from 30 years ago, which said you had to apply for refuge at your first port of call. And that is fueling racism in Italy and Greece and Spain. So I think we need a big kind of rethink at a European level. I think we need to put more funding into the developing world to give people a decent future in their own country, because ultimately that's better than sending the bright, best educated people to Ireland. It would be much better if people could stay in Tunisia, in Syria, in Nigeria and other places. But that is, you know, that's a lifetime's work to make that happen. But I do think we need to move beyond the kind of philanthropic approach to the world order of we'll sprinkle a bit of money and everything will be fine into really targeted development aid. Ireland Aid actually has a pretty good record of really helping communities on their path to development. But I mean, what if we doubled our development aid or trebled it? And yet in some countries like the UK, they have doubled down on reducing it, as a result of which there are more and more boats heading towards the UK's borders. So I think it will be a tortuous debate. I think people are trying to get very simple messages across that the immigrants are the bad people and the existing residents are the good people. But I mean, that incident that sparked things off in Dublin was a terrible stabbing of children outside of school, where my own kids went to school, actually. But I mean, the individual, it seems very clear that there was a huge history of mental illness there. And, you know, it's not just immigrants who have mental illness. We have them in every population. So to simplistically suggest that migration is the cause of all our woes is dangerously simplistic. So I think that message needs to get out there. But also, we need to think a little bit about the role of new media, of social media, in driving people down rabbit holes that are echo chamber for like-minded people. Because I think the escalation of violence in Dublin a month ago absolutely came from the way in which messages were bounced up on social media. And I'm glad to see that Thierry Breton, our European commissioner, is taking action against X for actions that for what they may have done. And that is not unrelated to the events that happened in Dublin. If you amplify hate on social media, you will drive violence. And I think there's a real danger and there is a need for control. Not that we're trying to silence people, but certainly, you know, you cannot shout fire in a crowded theater, and we need equivalent measures in the world of social media. And that is one of the challenges that we have with the Digital Services Act. And we'll see how that plays out over the coming months.
So two last questions. You've been very generous with your time. I appreciate you've got probably a lot of us on your plate today, Kieran. So thank you, first of all, for that. But a couple questions then. First, what are you looking forward to in 2024? What's going to be on the agenda, you know, in terms of policy in this area?
I think we've passed a lot of legislation recently. You had mentioned earlier the corporate due diligence legislation. A lot of these new laws, they take time. They take 2 or 3 years before they crank up. And generally, then suddenly we have a row about them 3 years after they were passed. That's the way Europe works, because we generally don't have rows, but the rows happen in our domestic parliaments. What am I looking forward to? I'm looking forward to seeing corporate due diligence have an impact on our supply chains. I'm looking forward to seeing the work we've done on simple stuff, like just having one common charger, of people kind of going, oh, it's great, I don't need to have a box full of cables anymore. Little things that are having an impact. Watching that happen, and maybe people will feel a little bit more positive about what Europe can do. That having been said, there is a huge amount of work that is needed, and particularly with the pushback against sustainable initiatives coming from the far right, we need to revisit the pesticides directive. We need to revisit the European nature law that comes in for a final vote, I think, in February. There's work that needs to be done, more work on climate to actually get to a 90% reduction by 2040. All of these will require new laws or the reform of existing laws. And I think the debate around the European elections, I'd like to see it focus on the decade of change and why we need green voices on the European stage in the years ahead.
So next question, what's your message on the doorstep? Someone in Stony Batter is going to say to you, why on earth should I put you back into Strasbourg, into the European Parliament? What's your one line?
I think I have a track record of delivery in Europe on greener buildings. Another law I was the negotiator on was moving towards the greening of aviation fuels. I know how Europe works. I can be a diplomat or a maverick, depending on the meeting and the particular issues at hand. I'm effective. I'm making change happen for a union of 440 million people. If you want that to keep on happening, you better vote me back.
That's excellent. And then finally, we haven't seen each other face-to-face in, gosh, I mean, I think the last time would have been in 2006, around thereabouts. So what do you think would surprise 2006 Kieran Cuff about the 2023 version? Here you are brokering deals, you know, getting compromises through. What would have been surprising to that younger version of yourself?
I think I've become a little bit more diplomatic as I've got older. And I happily kind of rub shoulders with my right-wing colleagues and say, look, let's have a coffee and have a chat. And we might agree or we might disagree. I was probably a little bit more comfortable with the megaphone in 2006. I'm still happy to take one up today, but I think I've learned better listening skills. And particularly when you're dealing with people of all political persuasions from 27 different countries, you absolutely have to listen carefully to the concern that's on their mind. And people need to be listened to. And that's a key issue when it comes to, also it's about migration. It's a key issue when it comes to rapid decarbonization of our energy systems. People have fears, they have worries. And if you don't stop and listen and tease things out with them as a legislator, then you're not going to get things across the line.
That seems like a good place to leave it. Kieran Cuff, MEP for Dublin, Green Party, thank you for joining us, and we wish you your family the best.
Thank you, Richard. Look forward to catching up. Hopefully it won't be 15 or 20 years next time.
Well, indeed. And I look forward to, you know, kind of maybe even seeing how you're doing on the doorsteps as the elections approach. So maybe we can meet up for a pint. That'd be great.
Love to. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Wicked Problems. And if you like this conversation, please share it and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps people find the show. You can subscribe to our newsletter at news.wickedproblems.uk, where you could also find more episodes with Richard Delvin and Claire Brady and all our show notes. And consider becoming a paid subscriber to help support our work. You can also find us wherever you get your podcasts. For now, thanks for listening.
This program is brought to you in part by Ireland, the ancient birthplace of good times.
First came the Vikings, then the Normans, the Saxons. All of them found Ireland irresistible. So think what a grand time we'd show you. Especially since you'd be the only ones of the lot we actually invited. Ireland.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.